Oh boy, Rebecca. We're back for another edition of Book Nerd Movie Hour, or 2 hours or 3 hours. I don't know how long we're going to go.
Well, I'm here for, you know, the life sentence.
On the formidable, estimable, durable, The Shawshank Redemption. Written and directed by Frank Darabont, based on a Stephen King novella, short novel, that appeared first in different seasons in, I think, 1982 is when that first came out, which also produced the short story that became Stand By Me, which became Rob Reiner's big hit, which launched his career. Rob Reiner named his production company Castle Rock Entertainment in homage to Stephen King, since Stephen King's fictional town is Castle Rock, Maine. So we're a whole lot came out of this interesting novella collection.
And also the short story that the Apt Pupil movie was adapted from as well. There's a lot going on in this book, and none of them are horror stories, really.
None of them are horror stories, which, if you needed any additional testimony to King's supreme storytelling acumen, it's hard to look past Stand By Me, the movie Stand By Me, and the movie Shawshank, the Shawshank Redemption became, because they are very similar to the novellas out of which they come. I think in both cases they're better, but only because I think they're richer. They only because they have more time with characters and settings and stories. And a lot of what you love about both of those movies is there in the novellas themselves.
Yeah. I'm just happy we're doing a bonus episode about a thing we both really liked this time.
Yes. Well, I mean, the Book Nerd Movie Hour ones.
Yeah, these have been
we're
fun.
Picking them because we like them. All I guess at some point we might do it to throw spitwads, but it doesn't seem like we're going to do that. So The Shawshank Redemption, let's talk about the book first. I mean, everyone knows this because of the movie, right? There's very few people that are like, oh, yeah, this is that novella, right?
Right.
Because it's also the novella has a different title called Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption. Weirdly, my paperback edition that I bought has a super title. I don't even know how to describe it, called Hope Springs Eternal.
Yeah,
Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption. I've never seen something like that before.
Yeah, so I think we must have gotten the same paperback edition of this. This was my first time reading the story. Was it yours? Or had you read it before?
Yes,
it was your first time.
Okay.
Yeah, and like the title of the book is Different Seasons, and each section of the book is titled after a season. So there's Hope Springs Eternal, and then the story inside that is Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption. And there's like after that is an introduction with a summer, or a section with a summer title, and that story then is The Apt Pupil, and then it goes on. So there's like the seasonal setup and then the actual story title. I don't really understand it, but okay.
Maybe it's just a way he had some short novellas to put together, and this is a way of like providing some connective tissue, because they don't matter.
It does nothing.
The seasonal grouping or assignation doesn't seem to matter at all.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
But let's talk about the novella reading experience. Impossible now to read it without seeing the characters, hearing Morgan Freeman's singular narration in The Shawshank Redemption. Is there anything, I guess, why don't you go first, evaluate your experience of reading the novella, having probably like me seen The Shawshank Redemption on cable 10,000 times.
Yeah, you know, I don't remember the last time that I watched the movie from start to finish, because it is one of those cable rewatchables for me that, you know, you pick up at any time and watch it for an hour, watch it through to the end. I certainly heard Red's voice. So there's the two main characters, Red, who is played by Morgan Freeman, and then Andy Dufresne, played by Tim Robbins in the film. And Red narrates the story for us. I just loved the voice all the way through. And I was so pleased then watching the film afterwards of how much of the language in the movie comes directly from the text. Yeah. But from the very beginning of like, I'm the guy who can get it for you. And Red's telling us about not just what his role in the prison is, and that he's kind of the fixer, procurer of things. But also we know right up front that like prison security isn't totally tight because you can get these things in and out, and that everyone knows this and is part of the system that you have to like let guys have a little something or everyone will go nuts. I loved the like the detailed characterization and seeing Andy Dufresne through Red's eyes in the text, little like just these great details that we don't quite get in the in the movie of like, he always looked as if he should have been wearing a tie. There was an element of fantasy to him, a sense almost of myth magic. And then later on, Red talks about how Andy has a sense of his own worth, or maybe it was only a sense of freedom. It was a kind of inner light he carried around with him. Just the depth and like emotional depth, not just descriptive depth of how we see these characters and of how Stephen King understood them through Red's eyes was, I just loved it so much. And it's funny. Like the book, I think is funnier than the movie.
Well, there's something about seeing the violence in the movie is ratcheted up, and we'll talk about some, and it's also different to see it. It just is. This is a movie book thing. I think we're going to come back to around and around. It's different to read about violence than to see violence.
Yeah. Yes. And like the violence, on the page also did surprise me. And I think I texted you at one point about like, oh boy, there's a lot more like prison rape on the page than I was expecting or than I was ready for. I was really surprised, given like that the book was written in the 80s and we talk about rape really differently now, of the level of sensitivity that was there, that like Stephen King understood that when he wrote this, that rape is about a power dynamic, that it is a thing that occurs in prison and that it occurs in the context of power dynamics and cruelty. He's not joking about it. Like it's not a wink, wink thing about, you know, like it's handled, I think, with a lot of sensitivity. Some of the descriptions of it don't age well for 2019, but that was just, it was a tough read. Watching it, also watching the violence in general, we'll get to that, was tough. But there was much more humor on the page than I expected. And like one of the critical differences between the stories is we know in the book that Dufresne has come into prison and brought $500 with him. and Red is talking about how did he manage to do that? And I just thought the line was great where he says, you know, when you're coming into prison and you're getting the full body search, one of the bellhops is obliged to bend you over and take a look up your works. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of works.
Red's euphemistic talking is good because it's there. And also when talking about the sexual violence, it's there. Talking about Brooks, his own plight, it's, you know what he's saying without being overt. And I think that's one of the real strengths of the book and the movie. Little, I mean, one of the things the movie, because it's just much more popular, has been criticized for is the sentimentality. We'll get there at the end. But the book is less overt about the sentimentality. Spoilers, we should say we're going to spoil everything. But when the pullback on the beach in Mexico where Red and Andy meet is meaningfully not in the book.
Right.
And King is a little more, there's more distance between us and Andy in the book and between Red and Andy in the book, because the book is clearly a narrative that Red is writing while he's in prison, then gets paroled in the middle of the writing of it. And his story changes in the middle of it. Like, I'm going to do this, and now I guess I'm going to go see Andy now. And I hope it ends with, I hope the ocean's as blue as it's been in my imagination, in my dreams. I hope when that's where it ends, we don't see it. And it's part of the pleasure of the novella is watching Red try to figure out Andy, trying to describe Andy. And those places, those passages you were talking about, I totally agree, are marvelous. And some of it is, it's Red's own interest and affection for Andy really shines through there.
Yeah. And like, there was even a part at the end where he's describing Andy, talking about like all the things Andy must have done to succeed in doing what he did. I mean, he says he was a methodical cuss. And I wrote in the margin of my paperback, like, what a great, I want someone to describe me that way someday. Like, what a great compliment, but that these characters truly, I think, see each other. Red, like, really sees Andy Dufresne, and you, that comes across on the page. There's just a lot more nuance, I thought, in the writing than we get on film. The movie, I love this movie, but I think I liked the book better.
Wow, that's a hot take, Rebecca.
I know. I know it was. We can get there a little bit more later, or a lot more. But that it's, the movie leaves us hanging on, and they talk about hope, but they have these sort of deeper discussions about it. And I think the film like is a little more overt, or maybe a lot more overt.
It's a lot. It's a long movie. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. It's one of the few movies I can think of where it would take me longer to read the source material than to watch the movie. And there's some scenes I think that come in the movie. I don't think there's a bad scene in this movie. I'll say that. I think there are some scenes that I wouldn't be sad if they were gone and actually change. I don't know. We'll get to the ending, but I think would come closer to the more subtle of the book. I agree. I think I agree with you there. That it's a text. I think you're 1,000% right that the position King gives Red in the prison as the guy who can get you things does so much heavy lifting for the book and for the movie, because again, it gives us this wonderful, you know, when Andy came to me, asked for Rita Hayworth, I said, no problem. Mm-hmm. And the first time you see that, it's hard to remember my first encounter with this because it's like the always already of my movie going watch is like life is the Shawshank Redemption. But even watching it now, you're like, oh, they know they're not actually talking about Rita Hayworth, but you don't know.
Right.
And they get to fill in the world building about how the prison works. Red is the master of his domain within the prison. He has the best connection. You never see Red get disciplined in the movie. It does happen in the book. He spends some time in the hole, easiest time I ever did, when he's laughing about something later, but that doesn't appear in the movie. He is playing it exactly like he's supposed to as someone's life sentence. He's got connections. He greases the skids with the guards, with the wardens. He's got friends. He did his time with the sisters. He says, you know, I wish I could, in the book, he says, I wish I could say I'm not speaking from experience about having been assaulted, but I'm not. But he got through it. He's putting in his time. He's saying exactly what he thinks he's supposed to say in the parole board. And he's playing out the string. He's a model prisoner, even in the way that the prison itself is okay with. They don't mind he's breaking the rules because he's breaking the rule within the confines of what they can accept. Whereas Andy is a sort of wild card, both for Red and for the Joker. I'm thinking wild card in my head of the Joker is the wild card of the warden. Mm-hmm. You know, we're okay with Red. That kind of disobedience we can handle, we can understand, we can tolerate. But Andy's sensibility is one we can't. And Red trying to scan and read Andy's difference is such an important part of really the first half of the movie and the book.
Yeah, and then they sort of hang a lantern on it in a conversation, in that first conversation where Andy tells Red about Zihuatanejo and that he has this dream of, you know, getting out and going, and that Red talks about understanding himself to be institutionalized and so used to living on the inside with the structures and the rules of prison that he wouldn't know how to be free out in the world. And there's that fundamental difference between them of, as Red puts it, that Andy like holds on to a sense of freedom and, like, you know, has this kind of inner light that he carries around and understands himself to really have agency in a way that allows him to do what he does in the story, where Red, I think, understands himself as institutionalized, and he's breaking rules, but he's like breaking the rules, as you said, that he's allowed to break in the way that he's allowed to break them, and just kind of getting by. Like, he has sacrificed the understanding of himself as free in service of survival.
Right. Survival is the right word. And I don't think it's a word weirdly, or maybe me, it's loudly quiet that they don't use the word survival. Cause you know, probably the key quote from the book and the movie is get busy living or get busy dying. And survival is the middle way, right? It's not living or dying. It's this middle term. And Andy is suggesting, if you're not going to try to live, which is to do something more than survive, why even play out the string? You're in prison. Is it worth surviving here? Isn't it worth taking a chance? Isn't it worth some other kind of thing? Because Red's initial reaction to the Zihuatanejo talk is hope is a dangerous thing, which it is if your goal is merely to survive.
Right.
Hope is dangerous if a good outcome for you is survival. If it's something more than that, you have to have hope. You don't only have to hope, but you have to do something about it and wager your body, wager your life in the context.
Right. And that's a real, like, what are you going to regret more kind of proposition.
Right.
And I think for Andy, it's hope is dangerous, but it's not as dangerous as getting stuck here.
Yes.
Getting busy dying. And for Red, the hope is dangerous because what if I try and fail and then it's even worse. My situation right. is even worse. Like, I've got a decent thing going. I can break the rules in this way. I'm a model prisoner. Maybe someday when I say the right words at the parole board, I'll get paroled. But he doesn't really want to get paroled mm-hmm. because he understands himself to be like a man on the inside. That his situation would certainly be worse if he attempted it and failed. And Andy's willing to accept that cost in a way that makes him unique in their relationship, but really unique probably in the world, certainly in the world of the story.
It got me thinking about this, what we just talked about, and I had this question in my mind as I was thinking about doing this episode. Let me pose this question to you. The title of the book and movie includes the phrase Shawshank Redemption. Mm-hmm. Who is being redeemed here?
Well, it's not Shawshank itself.
No, it's not Shawshank.
Yeah, I think the redemption word is really interesting. I think it's...
I think it's more clear in the book that this is Red's story.
Yeah, yeah. I do think that it's Red's redemption. Like, Andy is innocent, and we know that he's innocent through the whole thing. He gets confirmation. Like, everyone around him gets confirmation of his innocence, and so there's not a sin for him to be redeemed, but in a way, he takes the steps that allow Red his own redemption, his own freedom. Like, he gets Red free in a way that Red was never going to get himself free.
Even if Red never got out of prison, Andy provided something for him.
Yeah, and we see, and when we see Red leave prison, even before he leaves prison, he talks about how guys get out and then they commit some small crime so that they can get sent back to lockup because that's the only life that they know. And we see him have that experience that when he gets paroled, he thinks about this. It's more overt in the movie that he's thinking about doing something so he can get sent back to prison. I think he would have just gone down that path, gotten paroled and then gotten himself back in, if not for the example, the hope that Andy lights inside him. It's functionally like if Andy is carrying the inner light, he's able to fire that up in Red in a way that Red wouldn't have otherwise had.
Yeah, interestingly, and I'm now going to conflate or confuse the book and the movie, so I apologize, but I think it's in the novella too, where, you know, Red's nadir is he's following in Brooks's footsteps in the halfway house. He's living in the same place, doing the same job, having the same feelings, and he's about to do the thing that Brooks did, which is hang himself.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I would have ended already, except I made a promise to a friend. Mm-hmm. And it's not even the hope that he could, I don't know, feel better, but that his ethical connection as Andy is so strong that he at least wants to have tried to fulfill the promise. And when Red talks about being rehabilitated when he tries to get parole, he's saying the wrong things. The movie and book are telling us the rehabilitation here is that he's forged connection to other people. He cares about someone other than himself, that 20-year-old punk who killed someone, we guess, in the middle of a robbery. In the movie, in the book, Red's crime is much less forgivable, which we can talk about in a minute, but that he didn't care enough about other people as a young man, but forging a friendship with Andy was enough to get him, to pull him back from the brink, to try this one last thing, and to get him on a path where he might be able to hope. It wasn't that he could do it, but he thought it was worth trying. It was worth trying to fulfill the promise.
Yeah,
it's worth trying to fulfill that connection and play it out.
Yeah, there's a real sense of just like the power of humanity and connection, both in the book and the movie. And that's, I think, very difficult to do in fiction in a way that doesn't come across as too sentimental. It worked really well for me in both, but especially I found in the book. And that it's especially difficult and uncommon in stories about people who have done bad things. Like that Stephen King is telling this story set inside a prison is, I think, certainly no accident. And that we're asked and invited into looking at the humanity of these characters and understanding them to be not just ordinary people who have been in situations where they did bad things, but extraordinary in some ways. They're sort of like the extraordinariness of ordinariness. But it's this connection between the two of them that drives Red. And probably in some unspoken ways, like, we never got the flipped version of this. We're never going to get the Andy Dufresne narrative, switch. But I think we're also given to understand that this drives Andy Dufresne in some way as well. Like, he could have just planned to get out of prison by himself, but he shares all of this with Red for a reason.
Yeah, that question bothered me as too strong, but entered my mind is, if Red isn't there, does Andy's story change? It's obvious. I totally agree with you that if Andy's there, Red hangs himself in the halfway house. I don't think there's any question mm-hmm. about that. I think both texts are broadcasting that loud and clear. And what Andy gets from Red is more than transactional, I think, more than just getting the rock hammer and the rock cloth mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. It's not clear. And in the book, it actually makes a little more sense because you have so much more distance from Andy. Because, like, Andy's almost a mythical character to Red because he's piecing together from other sources things about Andy. There's things he doesn't know about how Andy did something. In the movie, since we know he ends up with Andy at the end, his gaps in knowledge wouldn't make as much sense. We don't get any of that. Mm-hmm. Well, I heard from sources that Andy did X, Y, or Z. Red is very much speaking there from firsthand experience. But what did Andy get from Red that was beyond Red's transactional way of understanding the world? Because Red did obey the law, and that's how he thought of his connections with other people as being transactional. It's this plus 10%. It's this or this. You give me this, and I'm making the bets. And it's fair, but is it ethical? It's fair, and there are rules, but is he really connecting with anybody? And right. It's when he gives Andy the poster for free after his time in the hole, I think it's the first time Red breaks out of his transactional worldview that he's built for himself in Shawshank. And that's important for him. When does Andy change? It's a little less clear to me.
I don't know that Andy changes. Like, mm-hmm. I think
he gets a break. He gets a break on that rooftop because Red says, like, right. you know, if it had gone on like that, I don't think he would make it, because he's basically getting serially raped by the sisters.
Yeah, he gets a break, but I don't think he changes. Like, I read it as like that Red sees him for the entirety of their relationship, or like from the first day that they know each other right on through to the end, mm-hmm. as this like almost mythical, inspiring, hard to understand guy. And Red says something in the book about like that Andy is the most like self-possessed person that he keeps to himself, that like you could know him for a really long time and not know much about him and only like get little bits and pieces out. And I think Andy is pretty Andy's character is pretty consistent through the whole story, that he's the vehicle of Red's change, and that he's there to be seen, like that mm-hmm. it's the act of seeing Andy like on a human level that changes Red, and Andy's just there to kind of exists on the page to mobilize that. He's an amazing character, but like this is a story about Red.
Yeah. Well, you know, now that I think about it, try this one on for size. So there's a great moment where Andy talks about, you know, he's doing the Zoatanao, and he talks about how, you know, Red finally knows that he's innocent. And Andy says, you know, it's bad luck. Whatever sins I had, I've paid for them. And he says his sin is really like, I killed her. Red doesn't agree with that. But Andy seems to say I made a mistake in my relationship with my wife. I loved her. Boy, I loved her. I just didn't know how to show it. I drove her into Quentin's arms. And Andy, until the rooftop scene, he's trying to live his life in his own bubble until the rooftop scene. And so his conversion really seems to happen when he gets this chance to basically get some leverage over the guards and the system at Shawshank. And his maneuver is not to do something for himself. It's to get beers for his fellow inmates, right?
Right.
He doesn't drink the beer. He gets it for them. And he takes pleasure from that and then becomes part of that coterie. So I think a plain text reading is that because Andy has this new power in the prison system, that's what changed it for him. But I really think him coming out of his shell and willing to be a part of that little social group and be Red's friend, that was the thing that saved him, rather than just the being able to be doing taxes. And if that's the case, then Red's and Andy's story are very similar. It's like, and for a story about male friendship, which this story very much is probably the greatest movie ever about platonic male friendship, both men have the same problem, which is they don't know how to connect to other people, which, as a Midwestern Protestant man, I have to say, it's very, very close to home, for this is a stereotypically, let me say, man's problem of not knowing how to connect with other people, not opening yourself, not being emotionally vulnerable, and getting yourself in it and acting out in a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. So we see men of all stripes acting out because they don't know how to connect with other people here.
Yeah, I can get on board with that reading. That rooftop moment is pivotal in the stories. The way that it plays out in the book and the movie that are different, I do think is meaningful in the like in both cases, Andy gets in good with the warden and the guard, and he's, and that's how he accrues power. But in the book, it works against him. Like he's accrued that power, and then he finds out that another prisoner knows the name of the guy who actually did kill his wife, and he goes and tries to get actions taken for that. But of course, the warden's not going to let him go because he's super useful, and he has to keep working against it. And ultimately, he escapes. And then in the movie, we find out that like, as he's gaining his power with the warden and the guards, he's embezzling their money for himself, for his alias, so that when he escapes, he'll have their money. And I did think that that, like, that long con in the movie is a lot more satisfying than the version in the book. The version in the book is that he had time between like the trial and having to go to prison to put money away, or like to protect the money that he had already saved. And so he's got like $37,000 somewhere under someone else's name and all the ID and stuff waiting, so that if he escapes, he can go collect the money he put aside for himself. Like, all the pieces are much more connected in the book. That like, there's kind of there's no way that the Andy of the movie is getting to Zihuatanejo if he doesn't do this with the guards and the wardens and take, like, siphon off their money for himself and then escape and then have that money to get there.
Yeah, that's an important difference. I mean, the movie, for as long as it is, adds some but also condenses some. And I think the place it condenses, like, there's multiple wardens in the novella and they coalesce in the form of Norton, which I think is makes all the sense. And what a wonderful villain. I mean, one of the great movie villains of all time, Warden Norton. Warden Norton. And then the hardest screw to ever walk a turn at Shawshank, the prison guard, also a wonderful character in that he is a manifestation, an embodiment of brute force being deployed whenever it's expedient. He's not about justice. He's not even about evil. It's about expedience. When it's Andy using him or being used on his behalf to beat the hell out of Boggs, it's the guard. When Norton is using him to shoot Tommy in the movie, it's the guard. He's just the application of force that's totally, he's not immoral, he's amoral, right? He's being used as just a tool in any particular situation. The guards are a little bit condensed, which is great. We get a lot more Brooks. Tommy's story is clarified, or no, it's not clarified, it's just altered radically, I would say.
Yeah.
In the book, I'm not sure. In the book, it's a tough beat for Andy with Tommy. In the book, basically the warden strikes a deal, we're led to understand, where Tommy can do less time in a better facility by shutting the hell up, right?
Yep.
He turns on Andy. He turns him in. And in the movie, he's murdered. I'm not sure. I think the movie one is more satisfying. I think the book one is probably better for the movie, for the story as a whole. I think that complexity is just better.
I agree with that. I think some of the violence and the villains are a little cartoonish, or they like walk up to the edge of cartoonish in the movie in a way that I found like a little bit distracting, and maybe because it's just subtler on the page and I had something to compare it to this time around, because Norton is, like, you're right, one of the great movie villains, but also played at like 11 the whole time.
Yes.
And the guard is, Hadley is played at 11 the whole time. And it just, when they killed Tommy, my notes actually just say they kill Tommy, WTF. Like, I didn't remember that. And like, now that I know what happens to him in the book, it's like, that was like, why did we also need this? It just felt like a lot to me. I did not appreciate that change.
There's not a lot of complexity in character who are not prisoners in the book. I think that's fair, right? I mean, that's in both cases, Tommy's the only one that's a little more gray. I mean, for a book and a movie that are basically rock-toned in both style and visual portrayal. Interesting that the gray is really the prisoners and how they're dealing. And we don't, in the book, the other thing the movie does better, and some of it's because faces are easier to remember than names, like the other prisoners just come so much more alive in the movie, because you get lose track of names and this little coterie of other prisoners that's such an important part of the rewatchability of the movie. Like William Sadler, who is probably the next most biggest part after Andy and read is wonderful and forgettable in the book. I can't even remember which, you know, prisoner is that supposed to be. He's an amalgam of several different ones. Okay, we're way into talking about the book. We're going back and forth. We need to get into cast and some other movie stuff. What else? Anything else within the book that we want to say at this point? Do we want to talk about Red's crime in the book at all? So the big changes, Tommy, the end, and Red's crime. Are those the three big things that are different? Is there anything else you want to add to that?
Well, Red's a white Irish guy in the book.
Yes, and... but weirdly doesn't matter. I mean, yeah, it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't really matter, except there's like a noticeable lack of other black people in prison in the movie.
Well, at least there's some. In the book, there's none. Like, yeah, we get the... Morgan Freeman's son is apparently one of the prisoners yelling fresh fish at one point. We get one of the nurses is black, but you're right. Noticeable lack of black people, but there's zero black people in the book as far as we're told. Played for a laugh. You know, why they call you Red, maybe because I'm Irish. It's a visual gag, right?
Yeah, it is a good, and that's, it's a good moment in the movie when that happens. It's a good, funny beat. There is a line that Red has early in the book where he's talking about like functionally prisoners as slaves and the way that like the dehumanizing way that guards view and treat prisoners. And he says like in prison, everyone is an N-word.
Yeah.
And I was like, oof, Stephen King, 1982. Like that was my, we have like later in our format, but the Joyce Carol Oates Oh No Award. And that was my moment of like, ooh, a white character saying this. And they like that line is noticeably not in the movie.
Yeah, right.
And it could have been delivered by the actor who
yes.
ended up playing the character if they had wanted to leave it in. I think it's a good choice to take it out. It's an unnecessary use of that word, I think, in the point King is trying to make in the book anyway. But you've hit the main differences.
I guess the ending, well, let's actually start our discussion with the movie in its production phase. So we talked about on the main podcast a long time ago this thing Stephen King does where he lets aspiring filmmakers option short stories for a dollar. And Frank Darabont did that with one of a different Stephen King short story, made a movie out of it that kind of helped him get his career going. You know, he established a correspondence with King. And when he had a little juice after, I guess he wrote the screenplay for Nightmare on Elm Street 3 was Frank Darabont's. He didn't make his bones there, but he got enough juice where he could make something else. He got the rights to Shawshank, the short story, for $1,000. That's what he paid Stephen King. Stephen King apparently never has cashed the check, which is an interesting little side nugget.
Oh, I didn't catch that in my research. That's great.
Never has cashed the check. Says, if I ever need it, I'll come to Frank for it. And Darabont wrote the screenplay in about 8 weeks. It's one he always wanted to make. He was showing it around town. Rob Reiner saw it, offered him $3 million to let him let Rob Reiner direct it. So, Frank, you wrote it. You'll get credit. But I want to direct it. And I guess Darabont had a long night of the soul for a week or so because he's a struggling. He's like, it would have made my, you know, I would have been set for money. But he really wanted to make the movie, turned it down, bet on himself, wrote, I mean, Robbins, Freeman, Reiner, a lot of people that were involved in the making the movie said it's the best screenplay they ever read. And the movie kind of bombed.
Yeah. And there's like one of the things I came across there was that one of the reasons that Darabont declined Rob Reiner's offer is that Rob Reiner wanted to make it with Tom Cruise and Harrison Ford.
The casting what ifs are mind boggling.
Yeah. He wanted to make it with Tom Cruise and Harrison Ford as Red and Andy Dufresne. And no. Darabont was like, I just don't see that vision. He offered it to Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks declined to do Forrest Gump, which came out the same year. And Tom Hanks won the Oscar in that year. Kevin Costner also declined the role. And apparently Charlie Sheen really wanted to be in this movie. Thank God.
Apparently did a 30-minute audition tape, which I wish I could watch.
Right. Like if the internet could source that, that would be great. Like that Jeff Bridges, Nicolas Cage, and Johnny Depp were also in consideration for Dufresne. And then the people in consideration for Red are a little bit better. Like Gene Hackman, Robert Duvall.
I think Robert Redford, you can totally see doing this. All the voiceover out of Redford totally makes sense.
Yeah, Paul Newman, Clint Eastwood as Red is one I'm glad that we avoided. So thank goodness that Frank Darabont went his own way here. And I love the bit, too, that Morgan Freeman insists that he's the one who suggested Tim Robbins to play this role. And in all of the research that I read, everyone else associated with the film is like, Well, if that's what Morgan says, then okay. Like, no one else is insisting that
you don't
it's
contradict
wrong.
The voice of God. You don't do that.
They're not saying he's wrong, but they're not saying that's the way they remember it.
Sure. If either. Morgan wants to tell that story.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. Bless your heart, Morgan. Right. I don't think there's any. There's only one casting choice I don't love. I don't love the character that plays, the actor that plays Tommy. He's not bad. I just don't know that he brings a whole lot.
Oh, Gail Bellows, yeah.
Yeah, Gail Bellows. Apparently Brad Pitt was offered that part, but he was going off to do Fight Club, I guess. So kind of, he was a little too big of a star even in 95,
yeah.
I think, for that particular part. There's not much interesting to me in the casting. What if I think everything is a landmine? I think Hanks could have been Dufresne. I think Robbins ultimately is better for reasons we can get into, but Hanks could have played Dufresne. Like, you watch Hanks in Philadelphia, it would be a similar kind of vibe, you know, that kind of aloof, intellectual, but also vulnerable and interesting and trustworthy. Like, that variety of Hanks in that time period of Hanks' life could have been done. But Tim Robbins is great. Let's talk about Tim Robbins, because I think his performance gets overshadowed by how great and incomparable and career-making. Right. And really, Morgan Freeman's voiceover narration is like a cultural product of the 20th century. Like, it's one of the great cultural products of the 20th century.
I totally agree. I think that Tim Robbins gets overshadowed here. He just looks haunted at some points in like a deep existential way of there is something going, like in a Stillwaters Run Deep kind of thing. Like, you want to know what Andy Dufresne is about. And we get little bits of it. We get that you need hope, and he's certainly persistent. But, like, there's just something, there's this, like, soulful gravitas that Tim Robbins portrays in a way that I do think Hanks could have done it. It would have been a different feeling, but, like, you're right, Philadelphia era Tom Hanks could have taken a crack at that. It's so hard to imagine it being
so
anybody
hard.
But Tim Robbins, and the way that he, like, it's notable that Dufresne's character is small in the book, and Tim Robbins is, you know, like 6'4", tall guy. That's a deeper, like, hole you got to dig to get out. But he's just so, he's embodied in an interesting way. Like, this thing that he's doing is so physical, to literally dig his way out of prison. And he is very, he does come across as very self-possessed, but there's this nuance to it where the character's not cocky. He's always, like, pushing the line a little bit. Like, he comes out of line, you know, on the rooftop to interrupt the guards, and you're supposed to never acknowledge that you're even listening to the guards' conversations. He's willing to, like, take a little risk. And Robbins just feels like the right amount of edge to me, where, like, I'm on the record from our Dan Brown episode of talking about how Tom Hanks has, like, zero to negative edge. And I think Dufresne needed a little bit of that. And Tim Robbins really brings it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe edge is the right word. To me, he's an interesting looking person, Tim Robbins. Like, he's unusual looking in his height for Hollywood. He doesn't have a classic Hollywood leading man's, like, sharp features. He's kind of roundish features, kind of an impish look at 6'5", which is an unusual combination. A knowing smile that is one of the great sort of acting,
like,
instruments we had in the mid-90s was the Tim Robbins smirk, which he deploys in almost everything I've seen him in, maybe most famously and originally in Bull Durham. But he looks like he's got a wink in his eye. And he's vulnerable, and he's tall and lanky and a physical presence, but not an intimidating, like, he's not a muscly big guy. He's a big guy. He walks around the village all the time, and Michelle and I used to see him walking around. He looks like a regular person. He's a little hippie, which I think works here. He's a little bit, he's got the kind of the floppy hair, and there's a little bit of looseness to him, which in the world of Shawshank, which is so regimented, like, the thing you have to learn about prison is the routine, as Red does. The looseness and angular, the floppiness of his hair and his body and his hands and his feet, just the whole thing, he seems a little cartoonish, which I think gives him a nice sense of being out of place when you're watching him on screen.
Yeah, that looseness reads to me also as just, like, a real comfort with himself.
Yeah, right.
And, like, this is a man who understands what he's about. And that's a contrast to Red as well. That, like, Red has spent his entire adult life in prison. He's never had the opportunity to discover what he's about outside of the context of institutionalized rules and practices. And, like, and any of it, and that he doesn't get to be loose in that way that Andy does. But I think Robbins, you're right, is a, he embodies that so well that it's like this really comfortable, like in his own skin kind of.
Yeah.
Like here I am, just not totally outside the lines, but not all the way in them either.
In one of our, we'll get to this movie at some point when we both have had like seven Prozacs and do Dead Poets Society. But it makes me wonder about Robbins as Keating, because he feels like he has like a college, an English professor's vibe kind of in the movie. And, I wonder, I mean, Dead Poets Society is earlier and yet Robbins would have been younger, and I'm not sure that it really works. But it feels like there's a kind of energy. It would have been a different energy, but I think he could have pulled off the inspiring, embodied, you know, self-assured, but also vulnerable thing that Robin Williams does
there's
in Dead Poets Society.
Like, there's just a real charisma.
Yeah, that's right.
And charm in a meaningful and authentic way, not in a like, you know, wink, wink, just give me what I want kind of way. And I think we really, we get more of that in the movie. This is one of those places that I think the movie serves us better, because you get to see him like really building out the library and spending time with all of the guys, getting books to them. And the letter writing campaign to get library funding gets bigger, I think, in the movie. And he has that moment with Tommy, helping him study for his GED and then mailing off the test, even though Tommy thinks that he's failed. And Tommy finds out when the results come that, that he's sent it off and he's done okay and all of these things have happened. Or no, it's not Tommy, is it? It's somebody else.
What?
The one who that Dufresne helps him get his GED.
Tommy? It's Tommy.
It is Tommy. Okay,
yeah,
right.
It's Tommy.
Like, was
it's
I
Tommy.
Okay, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and there's just like the sensitivity that he came into the prison with something that like Red and a lot of the guys who've been in there for a long time haven't had a chance to develop, and he keeps it.
Yeah. Other things the movie do better. I guess one of the character, if you had just read the novella and you're coming to the movie and you're like stock up, stock down in terms of character, you should buy Brooke stock coming out of the novella, because you don't know what Darabont's going to do with Brooks. A lot of that's in the movie is not in the novella. And James Whitmore, who is at the time a very well-known character actor, what warmth and gentleness in like nine sentences you get from James Whitmore, and a sad story. I think the stuff about institutionalization comes along a lot harder in the movie. Yeah. And I think it does itself a service through Brooks, through Red, through this is how it goes. If it work, even if it works out for you, where you get out after 30 or 40 or 50 years of a life sentence.
Yeah, I think so too. I loved the line in the movie, if I'm a convicted murderer who provides sound financial planning.
Like, yes, it, so good.
It brings across like the humor there. There's so much good, like straight from Stephen King narration. There's a lot more foreshadowing in the movie for what's going to happen. Like, we see the cell getting searched. We see Andy being nervous while people are looking through his cell. I liked that. I like the structure of the book a lot better, that we're hearing it all, like we're hearing it all after the fact, but like Red plays it up for us in a way that we don't know what Andy's going to do until it's done. And I can imagine like the first time that you read this book, you're surprised about what has happened and how Dufresne has pulled it off. And it's, there's so much more foreshadowing in the movie that it, I think it's much less of a surprise. What the movie does less well, I just think the movie is lacking some of the nuance that I wanted, or it becomes more overt in a way that I don't think serves it as well. Like, there's the whole thing about chess in the movie, of like Dufresne is talking about chess and the symbols of chess, and then he's carving a bunch of chess characters, or, you know, chess pieces. Like, that's, chess is such a commonly used stand-in or symbol in films for like, I'm a character who is strategizing and playing the long game. And I just didn't need a lantern hung on it in that way. I thought that was just a little bit too much. But it's beautiful seeing these characters on screen.
The one scene I've always loved, and I wonder now if, again, is the movie meaningfully better without it? I don't know. I think it changes one that's not in the book. It's also one of the few ad-libs where the scene is in the screenplay, apparently, where Robbins, or Andy plays the aria from La Danza de Figaro. Mm-hmm.
That's in my notes too.
And he turns up the music when the warden is there and he gets 2 months in the hole. At this point, we know Andy is different. I'm not sure what we know about Andy at that point that we don't know some other time. And knowing where he is on his scheme, does he really hazard building the digging out the tunnel for 90 seconds of that aria? It just doesn't feel like the coming out of the guy who plays chess, that feels like a wild move there all of a sudden. And then the stuff about music gets in down inside of you, the place they can't take it. Mm-hmm. I feel like I don't need that. I don't need it to be told to me at that particular moment that something else is going on here beyond just playing out the string in a movie. It just felt like too much. I get it. I get it already.
Yeah. It's one of those scenes where, like, it's a beautiful moment in the movie, and it's also totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
and right, like, he's taking a risk because he's getting sent to the hole, and who knows what's going to happen in his cell,
right,
or where he'll get reassigned when he
will get transferred to a different prison.
I loved seeing, and this is probably just like the book person-ness coming out, but I loved seeing more of the library and seeing Andy as the librarian on screen, and like imbuing that value of books to people and supporting the other prisoners in finding books to read and helping them get their educations. And like, there's this thread running through, as we were talking about at the top, of like, of what rehabilitation really means. And most of it in this story is about these characters learning how to be human to each other and to connect on the human level. But some of it too is about education and discovering the world. And like, the guards and the warden are not facilitating that. The only way that it happens inside the walls of Shawshank is the prisoners doing it for each other. And in this specific case, it's Andy, you know, fighting to get more books for the prison library and to make the library a thing, and like trading on the social capital that he has with the warden to make that happen. So I loved that. But yeah, there's like extra sentimentality in the movie that I think the book nails the tone perfectly. Like, it just nails the emotional tone of the story in a way that, like, when I came to the movie after the book, I was like, oh, this is too much.
Yeah. I think for my taste, I want a little bit more emotion. I want a little more connection between Andy and Red, rather than just Red sort of narrating, telling the story of Andy from a distance. I like the closeness the movie gets you between them. But if he came back one step, I think I'd be okay with that particular too. All right, favorite scenes, favorite quotes.
Okay, well, obviously, get busy living, get busy dying.
I mean, is that it? That's the signal. Is that the signature? No, I mean in the cultural consciousness, that's the quote, I think, right?
Yeah. And I love in the movie, there's, I had to come to prison to be a crook.
Yes. That gets a big laugh from Red in the moment, which is funny.
Yeah. Which is a good one. There are some like sight gags in the movie that I thought worked really well, when the warden is searching Andy's cell at the end and he puts his fist through the poster, and that's like how he discovers that it's hollow in the wall behind that. I love seeing that. But it's hard to pick out anything that's really any better than get busy living or get busy dying.
Well, I think that's a weird thing in this movie. For as popular as it's become over time, well, especially, oh, this is interesting too. The same year this came out was the year of Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction, which are two radically different ends of the sort of seriousness and stylistics.
And both incredibly quotable.
Very quotable and have very memorable scenes. Where Shawshank, which I think over time, Pulp Fiction is the better movie. We can fight about that some other day. But the more enduring popular movie is Shawshank, doesn't have as many scenes that you're going to quote back and forth to each other, as many quotable lines. It's really the emotional beats and story and feeling you get out of Shawshank, not that it's, oh, I want to watch that scene or say that line or do something else, which is very unusual. I
think that's right. That, like, Pulp Fiction is one of those movies that if it's on cable, I mean, I think it's like The Big Lebowski in this way, that like, if it's on cable, you can watch any one scene by itself, and that's a satisfying, like, that's a satisfying snack. You didn't get the whole meal, but the snack was satisfying. Mm-hmm. And Shawshank, you really need to see it through to the end for it to, like, the whole 2 hours and 22 minutes is about getting to, like, that, the moment when they discover that Dufresne is gone, and then the moment when Andy and Red meet up on the beach. Like, it's about that ultimate emotional payoff in a way that Gump and Pulp Fiction were about are really movies that are about
so much more episodic. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So much more episodic. I mean, I guess the two are, once they do the roll call in the morning and Dufresne is gone, that's a roller coaster to the end. I mean, you're on that train. You're just barreling straight through. The other scene, I used to do this for my friends. I'd make compilations of scenes from movies around a different theme, like be a car chase or a fight scene or something else like that. The other one I would pull out maybe in some compilation is the rooftop scene, because it's a nice moment. It's extremely powerful. It's compact, and it has an arc to it, because you end up at a different place at the end of the scene than you end up at the beginning. Andy's just, you know, along for the ride because he's made friends with friends. He takes a risk. He's very much in peril. And then he wins, and there's the sunshine, and, you know, I think a man feels more like a man if he has a bottle of suds at the end of the day. It's really beautiful, and the thing that turns him, and it's that one I think is pretty self-contained. The rest is like this slow, whatever the opposite of erosion is, the thawing between Red and Andy, and it's episodic. It's like a cruise. But other than that, I'm not finding myself like, boy, I could watch that scene right now. And I think that's one of the reasons it was so popular on cable. Like, there's a great story that one of the reasons it became so popular, I'm sure you and I were affected by this, Ted Turner needed content to fill out TNT in the mid-90s. And so he bought Castle Rock Entertainment's back catalog so he could air it for cheap, right? Because he had the rights. And so it was on all the time. In the midnight, even now, it's probably on TNT all the time because the cable company owns the rights. Kind of like what happened with *It's a Wonderful Life*. The one reason *It's a Wonderful Life* was on all the time is because I think it was NBC could get it for free, and they could just air it over and over again. It's weird how a contractual thing made this a thing. Like, I know we don't want to talk about that, but because it was on all the time, you and I and probably a million kids like us who didn't have cable or cars in 1998 were watching Shawshank, and we're just picking it up from wherever, and we just let it run for however, and you would change the channel and go do, and you would dip in and out of it. It became like cultural background noise in the late 90s, kind of strangely.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you have to be very familiar with a thing in order to become like very attached to it. And that just repetition of seeing this and picking it up at different moments and knowing where it's driving, knowing what the ending is going to be like, but you still want to get to the ending. You still want the payoff. I think it undeniably is a large part of how you end up with like Shawshank Redemption at the top of like greatest movies ever made lists. And it's like the highest rated, or at one point it was the highest rated by fans movie on IMDb. And there are a lot of pieces speculating about how and why that happened. But
can we talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, the availability of it.
But like other movies were available too. Like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves was on TNT a billion times. What is it about this movie that people respond to? Because Morgan Freeman says, people come up to him and says, you were, you know, in my favorite movie ever made. And people it was number four on the BBC's list of best movies of all time. I don't think they had TNT over in Jolly Old England. So like that's a contributing factor, but I don't think I think it's maybe necessary, but not sufficient for explaining the Shawshank phenomenon.
I think it's the hopefulness and that like sentimentality doesn't make necessarily for great movies, but it makes for enjoyable ones. Like I was thinking about the game that you and Michelle play about like what's your favorite and what's the best, and how favorite and best are often not the same thing when you're talking especially about like culture and media. And I think Shawshank falls into that. Like it's a great movie, but I think it falls for me into one of those the place of it's a favorite because of how it makes me feel. But it's maybe not like technically the best. Like I'm in the same camp with you. Pulp Fiction is the better movie. And I love Pulp Fiction and I can quote most of it back to you, but like I feel more about The Shawshank Redemption. And I think that people come from that place when they get asked about favorite movies or what you're attached to, is that like, what's their more emotional connection to? And like a lot of the stuff I read about this turned up, you know, people talking about it as a religious allegory and people talking about this movie like inspiring them to change something in their own lives in some way. Like people stop Morgan Freeman on the street and tell him Shawshank Redemption literally changed my life. And like, that's how do you compete with that? And also like Pulp Fiction wasn't doing that.
Yeah. I mean, I love this movie and I don't want to crap all over it. And yet, I mean, I got like, what's the movie about? Like, I think the sentimentality criticisms are maybe overblown, but that's what people are using to describe something else. And I think the other thing is what the movie about is kind of obvious, weirdly. I mean, it's not easy, but it's obvious. Like, hope is good. Like, that's not controversial, but it's sort of hard to The Shawshank Redemption lays out the utility of hope in a way that's something other than a wall platitude, I guess, is what it's about.
I think the book wins on this respect. And ultimately, this is why I liked the book better. Like, one of our questions here is, you can save the book or the movie. Which one do you take? And I'm taking the book because...
Wow. Wow.
I still love the movie. Please don't have me.
Wow. I need to drink something. Whew. Get a bottle of water. Wow.
Sorry. Don't send me an email.
Most controversial thing you've ever said. Holy Moses.
I'm taking the book because of two primary things. That we don't see Andy and Red meet on the beach at the end of the book, I think, is very important, because the book is about the function and utility of hope, regardless of the outcome.
Outcome, right.
That we need hope, that it's not about the outcome, but we need hope, and that hope as a motivating factor, like, at least moves us forward into some kind of action. And that, like, that hope is a catalyst for change, whether, like, in a system or in your own character, or both, or for helping other people change. And Andy, being motivated by his own hope, moves Red to have a kind of hope that he's never had before, and that changes who he is. And that, I love that. It needed to be open-ended, and Stephen King left it open-ended.
And notably, Darabont didn't want the ending it got. That was forced on him by the producer. He wanted to end it much like the novella, I think, which is Red on the bus with that last thing. I hope the ocean is as blue as it has been in my dreams. I hope.
Yeah.
Watch the bus go into a cornfield, fade to black. That's
right.
It.
That ambiguity, I think, really matters. Mm. That, that, like, if the bus had gotten in a crash 5 minutes after that and Red had died, he still would have been, like, he still would have lived his life in that place of hope. And I think that that's what's meaningful about the way Stephen King tells the story. And then on Andy's side of it, that Andy in the book is also just motivated by the hope of getting out and the hope of getting to Zihuatanejo. And he's had this hope in mind since before he went into prison, because he took care of his finances and he put them in place. And now he's just got to get back out and get to that money. And that the movie introduces this sort of revenge storyline of like, he's being used by the guards and the warden. And so he's also going to use them, that he had to come to prison to become a crook. Like, I didn't really want Andy Dufresne to become a crook. Mm. And I didn't love that. So I'm that's my hot take.
Yeah. No, I mean,
I feel like I should hide behind something.
I feel I have two minds about the ending, because I think my head is saying leave it with the bus, but my heart is saying the hug as you're pulling away, it does get me every time. I wonder if everything about the movie was the same except that, and it had the same story and it played on cable. Does it matter that much? Because I'm feeling like it might. I'm not sure what I think about it.
Scene of the movie is just Red on the bus.
It's just Red. Do people, is it that important? Was the producer right, I'm guessing, is what I'm saying, for people's affection for it? Because it didn't matter for the box office, because it didn't bomb, but it lost money. And apparently it was the most rented movie of 1995 also. So it made, and you know, whatever. I'm sure it's made up in value for whoever made it. Darabont's gone on to make The Walking Dead, and Morgan Freeman became Morgan Freeman. Weirdly though, Robbins, in hindsight, it's hard to remember now. He was a big star coming into this, a great performance, but kind of the end of Tim Robbins as a leading man. Mm-hmm. He directs Dead Man Walking, in which he, you know, has a huge hand that becomes a critical success, weirdly fallen out of the cultural discourse. What's the last Tim Robbins thing you remember?
Ooh, that's a good question. I did not go far enough down the Tim Robbins IMDb hole to answer
But I'm glad, because then what do you got? Like, what's next?
Yeah.
Because, like, the big Tim Robbins roles, you get Bull Durham, and you get this, and what else do you get? Rocky Horror? So I think this is the peak of Robin's career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Morgan Freeman, his best known role, clearly, but he goes on to be in Seven and other big movies. Like, Morgan Freeman becomes Morgan Freeman with this movie.
Yeah.
Darabont makes his career. No one else gets a big bump out of it. No one else is like, oh, that's, I guess, there's some people that you see in other movies like, oh, wasn't that the guy, the guard from Shawshank? Wasn't that the warden from Shawshank? It's their that guy roles for other movies they go on to do because it was seen so often. Fascinating cultural trajectory for the movie. It's really hard to, I can't think of anything like it.
So you're saving the movie.
I think I have to. Because I don't get Robbins as Dufresne. I don't get Freeman as Red. And I don't know what the book gets me that the movie doesn't. It gives me more. It gives me more with Brooks. Mm. You know, I don't know. I think you get Rita Hayworth flinging her hair in Gilda, which is just a wonderful scene. Watching the prisoner watch that is always a delight. I think I have to save the movie. I'm glad they both exist. It was interesting to read the book, but the book is not wildly. The only thing different enough in the book to be interesting to me is the end. That Tommy's story is a little bit different. Nah, doesn't matter. You get more about Red's crime. Nah, doesn't matter. And that I know there's a different ending isn't what I need from the book. Not that there's a different ending, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I found reading the novella to be like two of the most satisfying hours of my reading life in
That's something. Mm-hmm. Is it satisfying having not seen the movie, though? There's the unanswerable question, right?
Because you can't go back before. Like, I definitely didn't. I couldn't read it without Morgan Freeman's voice in my head.
Hard to know how much. You can't step back into the un-Shawshanked river. Things we Googled? Got any? I've kind of sprinkled mine throughout.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I had
anything else. There was nothing else that I didn't have very many, like, what ifs or weird wonderings about the book or the movie here. There wasn't a whole lot that I needed explained.
Shot in Ohio, decommissioned prison. They used exteriors for the prison. They used interiors on a soundstage. You can go. It's become a minor tourist attraction, apparently. You can go get Shawshank bundt cakes, apparently, in the little Ohio town. There's a lot of Shawshank merch. Questions? Oh, anything
this
else
is just
research?
A weird thing. I happened to pause it. I was watching it on Amazon, and I happened to pause the movie at like one of the moments where Red is out at the wall looking for the stone near the very end, and it pops up like random trivia. And so I learned that I learned in that moment that the set designers built that wall months before production began so that the alfalfa and everything around it could like grow up and sprout around it and look natural. And that you can or at one point you could buy pieces of the wall like off of, you know, charity auctions.
Wow. The oak tree apparently was there until 2015. It got struck by lightning and then slowly faded. So you could go, that'd be a really interesting list. You and I have talked about the Iowa cornfield in which Field of Dreams happens, also a future tier worthy Book Nerd Movie Club hour. But movie tourist destination things, I think I would never have thought before thinking about it, I guess this is how thinking works, to go visit the rock wall and tree at the end of Shawshank or to visit I can't remember the Marion County prison system or whatever it was to go see that. But I would like to see that. There's a really wonderful shot. Roger Deakins shot this, one of the great cinematographers of all time. And his skills aren't really on display because it is so tight and close on the characters and there's not a great color palette. But you get one helicopter shot early that comes up and over and around Shawshank. Mm-hmm. And you really get the world building in there. Made me wonder, I think Shawshank works as a play as well.
Oh,
if you
totally.
Wanted to do it as a play. Never thought about this before until I saw that shot, how contained the whole thing really is. Yeah, quibbles, questions, what bothers you still about the book or the movie?
I don't have a lot of quibbles left.
Oh my God, I've got like 17.
Do you? Mike, most of my quibbles came out in the course of this discussion, but I'm happy to let you be the one with more quibbles.
I mean, it's kind of logistic stuff.
Okay.
And again, I get it. Like, the escape plot is kind of like the murder in Crawdads. Like, I don't think you actually need it for the emotional thing. I don't think you need Crawdads at all. But for Shawshank, the escape plot is satisfying, but it's really Andy and Red's story, and you get the how you do it at the end. But is he really in the same cell by himself for 19 years? Is that how prisons work? I don't know.
Maybe if you are super successful at paying everyone off.
I think that's
what we're supposed to believe.
We're supposed to believe, but I'm just like, they never get moved. They never do any construction. There's never any maintenance at all. That, you know, no one notices there's a giant freaking draft coming in from cell block 5. That's one I'm wondering about a very real way.
Oh, and yeah, you do hear that in the book that that Andy has a cellmate for for like 8 months, and the only thing that he comments on is that there was like a bad draft in the cell.
That was a weird note. Yeah. I'm not sure why that was in there. Another quibble. Oh, again. So Andy's escaping. It's the night he chooses, and I think he chooses it because there's a thunderstorm. I'm not really clear where he's timing his rock strikes into the sewage pipe with the thunder and lightning.
Yeah,
which hard to do unless you know exactly how far the lightning is. And I don't think you can crack a hole big enough for a man in a steel pipe with a piece of the concrete he just tunneled through with a rock hammer. I just don't think you can do that. I don't know enough about it, but I'm not so sure.
I think we see too many of the logistics of the escape in the movie, and it does open up room for questions, where in the book, you know that like it's a very tight squeeze, like only a small guy, as he is in the book, could have gotten like through that hole, but that also he like lucked into the wall. Like there's details in the book that let us believe it about like the cinder block was made out of certain material that makes it really soft. He's able to crack through it. His cell happens to be against the wall that butts up next to one of the sewage pipes, and how he gets into it. Like there's like none of that having to break into the pipe or strike it as the lightning strikes happens.
Look,
in the
there's suspension of disbelief in all fiction. I'm totally willing to grant that. It's the point at which you choose to care. Yes. I guess on the other side of coincidence is at the beginning. So Andy Dufresne's wife and her lover get murdered on the same night that he's out there with a gun drinking.
Yeah.
Tough.
That reminds me of two things that, like, one thing that I missed from the movie that I loved in the book is Red talking about how Andy would have 4 drinks a year.
Yes.
And, like, his very careful description of it. So we know that Andy Dufresne has, like, really taken a look at his drinking and where it landed him, even though he didn't commit the murders. And the train just left the station. I just completely lost my train of thought the bit at the end of like the magic of Red reflecting on watching Andy walk around the prison yard and have dust come out of the cuffs of his pants. Just all is like, it's just all a little bit more subtle.
A little bit more subtle. Let me see what else I have for quibbles and questions. Oh, again, doesn't matter except that I noticed it. Is that volcanic rock in that wall in the movie different enough looking?
No,
that you would
not
pick it out.
I had a quibble with that in the moment too.
Okay, because you know Andy's saying, you know, you're gonna find a rock that has no earthly business being in a rock wall in Maine. I was like, oh, it's volcanic glass. I'm like, great, it's gonna be shiny or whatever. He picks it up. It looks virtually indistinguishable from every other dusty ass rock sitting there, and he has to find it under some other dusty ass rocks. I was like, that seems so weird. I guess in 19 years they want to show it's been there for a while, but it rains there. Can you not show that it's like meaningfully different? I was like, there's no way that Red wandering around in hayfields in Maine on some hot ass summer day is gonna find that rock. There's no way.
No.
And again, it does. Right. These are why they're quibbles. They don't matter. They don't matter.
They don't. It's still a great movie.
I think it is. It's a great movie. Those are my quibbles and questions. Here's my last one. And I'm part of this quibble because it's not about the movie. It's about, I don't know what the movie's about or what it's not about. Stephen King said he wrote it based on, you know, the movies and books and TV shows he watched as a kid about prisons. And we said in our annotated episode about the prison system that if we have a cultural idea of what a prison is like, if you're of our age, it is Shawshank, right? It's like this is a crucible of cultural representations of prisons that goes completely uninterrogated. Like there's the movie shows that prisons are bad, but it's taken as like the weather. Like you go to prison, it's bad. You're going to get raped. Mm-hmm. You're going to get beat. The warden is going to be a cheat. It doesn't work. And maybe just that all that is like, do you feel like there's a political message, enough of one for your taste? Or is it just that prisons are bad and you don't want to be in prison? Do you deserve to be treated like the prisoner's rights angle of this left me a little squicky in the end. I think King is really good about a lot of it. Like the warden is bad and the guards are bad and there's a power dynamic and the prisoners don't deserve what they get there, except the warden in the book especially is replaced by other bad wardens. It's just sort of a cycle of abuse. And of which the answer is that they're going to escape to Mexico.
Yeah, there's just a baseline acceptance of a certain amount of injustice.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, I think if I were seeing this movie for the first time in 2019 as my however fully formed this self is, I would have objected to that. It's hard to separate having known the story for so long, but it does it does depict bad things that happen in prison, and then it just presents them as this is the way that it is, and it kind of implies this is the way that it's always been, and also this is the way that it will always be.
Yeah.
And that is not satisfying in the way that Orange is the New Black has gone beyond that. There are we do have new cultural markers that who knows if that will stand the test of time, or if some of the other films and TV shows set in prisons will surpass the place that Shawshank has in our generation's cultural imagination. But Stephen King does come short there. That's one place I think where less subtlety would have been good.
Yeah. Or I'm not even sure if it's subtlety. I know now, because I've recommended on Annotated Chris Wilson's The Master Plan about his time in a maximum security prison serving a life sentence that he eventually doesn't have to serve through means that aren't climbing through rivers of crap and polishing rocks. That is, overtly talks about how the system is messed up. And this says the system is messed up, but ends kind of there. It's like saying cancer is bad.
Right.
Cancer is bad and it's just cancer. Why are you going to worry about cancer? I did notice, though, the warden says when Andy comes to him to write letters about money for the library, the warden does say the only thing people have any tolerance for with prisons is three things: more prisons, more walls, more guards. Mm-hmm. So there is an indictment in that of the public understanding and appetite for thinking about prisoners as anything other than people in a box being subjected to that. So I don't think it's completely this is just the way it is, but it did strike me as especially considering how important it is to my own sort of cultural imagination about prisons, that it treats it like an inevitability rather than something that is made by man, propped up by man, and theoretically could be dismantled and utterly deployed by man.
Right.
So. But it's not about that. It struck me this time as a place it didn't want to go. And probably one of the reasons it's so popular is it's good for all time zones. There's not a political message here. Hope is not a political message, I don't think. If you're a Republican and you're watching this movie, what do you object to? I don't think much, if you're more conservative than we are. Because it's not about politics. It's about, if in my dark night of my soul, is it more than hope is good? Sometimes I'm saying yes, and sometimes I guess that's my ultimate quibble, is yes, hope, despair is bad. Who has ever said otherwise, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, if Stephen King were to write the book today, if all of those things, or if the movie were to get made today, if all of the wokeness of 2019 gets imbued into the story. And it's also meaningful, if it's set in a prison in 2019 versus if it's set in the 40s and 50s. Some of what we're getting is that was the cultural moment of the time that the characters lived in. And I don't think there was a lot of discussion about prisoners' rights and what rehabilitation actually meant happening. So it's it's a tough read, and there are progressive, we know Stephen King to be a pretty progressive guy in real life. And there's progressive stuff in this text, even from the 80s. I was really surprised about the level of sensitivity around the prison rape stuff. So it doesn't ring all the bells that you would want a 2019, hard hitting analysis of prison life to hit. But I don't think it does a terrible job. And it's just an open question, I guess, of how else you could have told the story, how else King could have told it. And one of those tricky moments of we just know some things now and talk about some things differently than we talked about them 35 years ago.
Well, and I guess my last note I have on this, the movie that I wanted to talk about for a minute, it's kind of related to this, is that the movie and the book read to me as more fable-like than anything. And to write a fable like this, because, this came out in 1982. King was probably writing it in the fall of 1981, because that's how Stephen King rolls, because he's just always writing and publishing, which is incredible. But he was setting it 35 years, the beginning of Shawshank started 35 years. He chose to set it in the past, a meaningful past, one that he has read. And it's a fable-like setting for him. It's a morality play of a kind. And probably it's best for the long-term endurance of a work like this to not be caught up in the particular political discourse of a moment.
Yeah.
So I think that does its service. It's a trade-off, I guess, is what I'm trying. It could have been more about prisons are bad and we should get out there and vote and dismantle the mass incarceration system. I would not be mad at that particular take of a Shawshank remake or something like that. But the virtue of not doing that, I think, is longevity.
When
I think
it
becomes more enduring to be outside of a particular moment and embedded in a sort of near mythic recent past.
I agree. And I also think that if the story and if Red's narration in particular had become about a real look at the prison system, then you lose a large portion of what else is going on with the characters and their motivation to get out. And like that their hope is this fantastical thing,
right,
of digging a hole, like spending 20 years with a rock hammer, chipping through the prison wall, going through a river of poop, and then magically somehow getting to a beach in Mexico where the Pacific Ocean has no memory. Like, this is the thing they have to hope for. That's how bad life is, that like this is the thing that they have to hope for. Comes through really, I think, really strongly. And if the story had been turned into something that's analytical or supposed to be politically motivating, it's hard to marry that with the same kind of motion that Andy Dufresne needs to take to make this story work in the way that this story works.
No, yeah. I agree. I guess the other subtext that makes me a little uncomfortable is like, well, if you just have enough willpower, you can beat the system.
Yeah,
like we know that not to be true about systems. Like, okay, there's examples, and that is Andy an exemplar, or is he a exception? I think that question is very interesting.
Yeah.
To me.
Oh, I felt like it's pretty clear that he's an exception, like because Red describes him as like a myth man from the very beginning.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and then
Red is the everyman. I guess that makes sense, because then Red is the everyman, and the thing that Red does, we may not be, as the viewer of the movie, we may not be able to do the things that Andy does, but we could maybe do the thing that Red does, right? We're not supposed to be Superman, we're supposed to be like Lois Lane.
Yeah.
Or Jimmy the photographer, right?
And that comes through, I think, on the page much more than in the book.
I think that's a great point, yeah.
Yeah, that Red thinks about, like, when Andy succeeds in getting out, Red thinks about, like, all the nights that Andy must have, like, had his heart beating out of his chest, knowing that, like, you know, a guard walking by at the wrong moment or a random search of his cell at the wrong time could have just ruined everything. That like a bunch of things had, all these dominoes had to fall in exactly the right order and nothing could go wrong in order for Andy to get out. And he, like, a lot of it is his persistence, but a lot of it also is that he's just lucky and he has this like mythical magic to him that we hear about from page one.
Yeah, and I guess that we're kind of talking around the same thing. And the ending, the ending evaporates any motivation you'd have to go look at the prison system again, because you're thinking about Andy and Red hugging. They don't go. They're not like, hey, okay, now we're in Mexico, we're gonna go reform the prison system.
Right.
We're gonna start a letter writing campaign to end mass incarceration in Maine in the 1960s.
Yeah.
But this is why I like doing these, because I would never think about this without needing to talk about it for a few minutes. So
yeah,
I appreciate
totally.
People listening and you taking the time to think along with me. What are we going to do next? We don't have the last for Hunt. I knew this was coming when we did Da Vinci Code. I'd already signed Amanda up for Hunt for Red October.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't talked about what's next. Do we have a next? Do we know what's next for Book Club Movie
We
Hour?
Don't have a next. I guess we could pick one.
Let's do 2 minutes of contenders, and if people have feedback, don't just random thing. Don't email us with things we haven't talked about, because we
right. Okay, so we're scheduled. Our bonus episodes are scheduled like through November,
right?
So we would be recording probably around the holidays. Like, I could drink some extra eggnog and do Dead Poets Society.
Is there a great Christmas holiday adaptation movie to do?
Oh.
Is there a great Christmas Carol adaptation? I tend to think there's not.
No, I love Scrooged, but it's like a sideways adaptation.
Yeah, I can't think of a Die Hard is, or depending on your vantage point, is or is
it's
not
just
a Christmas movie.
3 hours of people arguing about whether or not it's a Christmas movie.
It is based on a book, though.
So other things we've talked about are Field of Dreams, a river runs through it.
Jurassic Park.
Yeah, Jurassic Park. And there's going to be...
You've got Mail, even though it's not a it's a bookish movie, don't at me. Dead Poets. Wonder Boys is one I'd like to do at some point.
Mm-hmm.
What, any of those jump out at you?
I like all of those movies. If we do Wonder Boys, we're going to have to talk about professors having affairs with their students.
I don't like that.
I know you don't.
Is there an affair between a student and a professor in that? Or almost, just almost. Is that enough?
Oh, I don't remember the particulars. It's enough to feel squicky about.
Oh, I'm not saying I don't feel squicky, but I don't know that actually, you know, I don't think there's any extra credit happening.
I would love to hear from our listeners with some...
Yeah, okay, that's enough for now. We won't decide until we've said we've decided, but your open podcast at bookriot.com. Would you save the book? Let us know what you thought about this. How hot was Rebecca's take about choosing the novella? Like, was it a habanero? Or was it like drinking strontium 238?
Look, I love this movie.
It sounds to me like you hate it. That's what I heard. You hate this movie. Freeman's a hack. That's what I heard.
Lacking nuance, Jeff.
Yeah, lacking nuance. Rebecca, I'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.